You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is March 4th, 2020. We have just begun the season of Lent. As I said last week, we'll talk about something more spiritual this week, but I would like to conclude what I did last time on the year 1944 and Stalin's description of the defeat of the Germans. Reading Suvorov's later books is really extraordinary. Icebreaker was incomplete. Suvorov's understanding of the situation in 1939 to 1941 completely changes how you view the war. Like I always say, everything that the average educated American believes is false. We're told that Hitler had a bent for world domination. Yet at the time he invaded Poland, he had something like 3,000 tanks, really 2,800 tanks. About half of them didn't even have cannon on it. The rest actually only had the 20 millimeters. It couldn't destroy very much. By June of 1941, he had about 3,300 tanks, all of them light, all of them obsolete. Stalin had almost 30,000. There is no way that Hitler attacked Russia thinking that this is going to be a war of conquest. It was a desperate, preemptive attack. Hitler didn't even have long-range bombers. Hitler was out of fuel very, very early on. Fuel was already at a crisis level in 1940. According to Sir Basil Little Hart, General Halder, and many others. Stalin's heavy tanks were far superior to anything the Germans had. The artillery was far superior. It was absolutely, the lack of long-range bombers. You know, this was with the time Operation Barbarossa begins. Britain was already bombing Berlin. What did he think he was going to do? Hitler had no strategic aviation at his disposal. Stalin didn't believe the initial reports of an invasion because he didn't think Hitler was that nuts to do it. But it wasn't a matter of insanity. It's that he had figured out what Stalin was planning. Everything seized. And the forward armies, the Soviets, were offensive. If you read enough about Soviet military doctrine, there is no such thing as defense. It doesn't exist. It's an offensive army only. There's also no reason to believe that he thought that the war was going to be over in a few months. He did not believe that. Stalin was able to field early on about 6 million men. A few months, what's that, a million men a month? Taking Moscow would not have ended the war, and everyone knew that. Yeah, in 1940 even, as early as 1940, he wasn't able to knock Britain's industry out of the war. He'd already lost the Battle of Britain. Italy, of course, always was a drain on him. To think that he actually believed he could win this is nonsensical. Fuel was already at a crisis level. 2 weeks to the invasion of Poland, fuel was already at a crisis. So says General Halder. It wasn't until late in the war that the heavy tanks were developed. Horse-drawn carriages were the big invasion force. It was something like 200,000 horses. No one believed normally that the war is going to be over in a few months. I mean, even if, you know, Suvorov said, even if Hitler could take 1,000 kilometers a month, which was impossible, it would still be about a year of war. And of course, 12 months of warfare straight is impossible in Russia because of the mud. Knocking Moscow out of the war doesn't mean much. Hitler was in no position to invade Poland, let alone the Soviet Union. You know, Blitzkrieg is an armor-based method. And every time they tried it early on, they failed. It sputtered very early on. The weather had absolutely nothing to do with it. Even if you read Mein Kampf, he says back then that an invasion of Russia is impossible. Even talking about World War I, he says in chapter 14 of Mein Kampf, he says, you know, any war between Germany and Russia is a loss for Germany. He thought it was absurd. But to have a blitzkrieg with little fuel in a place as big as the Soviet Union is absolutely impossible. Germany wasn't ready for war anywhere, let alone against the Soviet Union. They had already lost against the British in the air, and German cities were already being bombed. General Halder says in 1940 that an air war on two fronts is not possible. And still, military production didn't increase in this period of time. General Halder says in December 3rd, 1940, the fuel situation is very bad. Rubber in tires. Crisis. He says in 1940, capturing Moscow will not have any significance. In Hitler's opinion, and facing a war on two fronts is absolutely impossible. He says in January of 1941, anti-aircraft gun battalions, the Land Army, haven't been prepared yet. January 28th of 41, we could count on a fuel supply of 2 months. They all knew this. And Hitler knew this. And Halder didn't even realize what Operation Barbarossa was all about. Hitler's tanks were barely functional. They were small and light. The ones that initially were in Barbarossa had a 50-horsepower engine. The Panzer Mark IVs, he had a handful of them. And they weren't produced until 1944 in any great number. Stalin had almost 30,000 with the long barrel cannons, the wide caterpillar tracks, diesel motors, etc. An endless means for producing these tanks. A lot of the tanks Hitler was using early on were captured from the Soviets. Hitler was supposed to try to conquer the world with 6 tank divisions. What kind of blitzkrieg would that be? And very few, until 1944, few new tanks were being produced. They were simply reassigned, as I tried to bring out last week. That was the point of this whole thing. Hitler was in no position for a war against anyone. France was, because German tanks were so light, and the situation was completely different, and France had no stomach for another war. But, three-quarters of a million horses, General Blumentritt said we had in 1941. 220 horses followed each tank. This was what's going to be the blitzkrieg here. 153 divisions launched against the Soviet Union. 17 were tank divisions. There was not a single tank in the 13 motorized divisions at the beginning of World War II, but each Soviet rifle division had its own tank battalion of T-26. The German infantry didn't have tanks at all. So this is, you know, everything you know about this is false. Hitler sacrificed himself, Germany sacrificed itself, to defang Stalin. And even the situation in Finland. The situation in Finland, you know, Stalin had smashed through what was supposed to be impregnable Finnish defenses. Yet that first winter was rough. The other thing Suvorov says that's worth talking about is the purging of the high command in the Soviet army wasn't irrational. The new commanders, by the time Barbarossa started, were far more educated than the old ones. The old commanders of the Red Army were revolutionary veterans. They were from the Revolutionary Civil War. These aren't real field commanders. That's what he was purging. I mean, Germany hardly had the non-ferrous metals to manufacture the artillery shells. The war was suicide from the beginning, but Hitler did it because he realized that if Germany was to do anything, it was at least going to sacrifice itself against the Soviets for the sake of Europe. This is, you know, there's nothing that you hear about this invasion and this war is true. This was a desperate sacrificial measure because of what Stalin was planning. Stalin had no reason to fear Hitler and couldn't believe that he actually was willing to invade with really only one source of fuel, and that was Romania. All Stalin had to do was take Romania, and that was it. There's no Third Reich anymore. Everything was based on that. And of course, Mussolini, as I've said many times, was a huge drain on German resources. So there was no chance of Hitler invading any earlier than he did in 1941 because of the mud situation. This was a desperate 11th hour gamble before Stalin's forces poured over the border. And the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was signed. The first thing Stalin did was dismantle all of his defensive organizations. Everything became offensive. And even German tanks, the motor wasn't even meant for any long distance. It had a very short operating time. Same thing for the planes at the time. Any army had to stop every 2 weeks or so for overall repairs. And even if Moscow had been taken by August, which very few people thought would happen, they would still have to go towards the Volga. They would still need to stop and repair and retool and let the horses catch up. Not to mention building forward air bases, because Germany didn't have a fleet of aircraft that could fly long distance at the time. This was an act of sacrifice. And almost up until the very end, Hitler still had this idea that the Western Allies would never ally for long with the Soviet Union. And yet he was wrong. Stalin was superior to Hitler in almost every regard. The German, the Du-17, the Ju-88, Hu-111, these were not for bombing industry. They were completely different. This was small-scale, mobile target bombing. He didn't have the capacity to bomb whole cities in the east. These were small. Any distance meant that very few bombs could be loaded up. Low altitude. If he's going to reach the Urals, he couldn't even have bombs because it would be all fuel. Germany was running out of fuel in August of 1941. Large-scale operations ended in August of 1941 because of a lack of fuel. And even if there were a lot of fuel in the rear, getting it to the front was very hard, especially in the north where there's no roads. Anyway, so that's how I wanted to finish up the talk last week about Barbarossa and explaining wrapping it up, what exactly I meant to summarize what I was trying to get across. Today, though, I want to switch completely. I want to switch eras and topics and go back to certain spiritual and historical matters. There's a man I want to talk about that none of our people ever talk about. An Orthodox, whether Eastern or Western Rite, he almost never comes up. In fact, he never comes up. And it needs to change. I'm going to be the first to change that. And that is the great Hikmar of Reims from 806 AD to 882. He was the Metropolitan of Reims in France. He was, in my opinion, a true father of the church. and he belongs in the patristic canon. Because he was metropolitan in France at the time, and supporter of Charles the Bald and the Carolingian dynasty, he was an opponent of the papacy. Already you see the Gregorian reforms, of course they hadn't existed yet. This is the 9th century, but the outline was already beginning, because we're still in the Phocian Schism at the time. And if the Greeks were to be jettisoned in some way, and they're no longer a problem for the West, the papacy would then completely take over. Hincmar of Reims was one of the most essential church leaders of the Carolingian Empire. He was an excellent theologian and philosopher. And one of the things he's known for is defending the national Gallican synodal system against the papacy, especially Nicholas I. And he did it through his defense of metaphysical realism, the opposite of nominalism. Nominalism can't grasp anything, whether it be corporations or the Eucharist or sacraments or even the church itself. Hincmar lived at a time of great tumult. Most of you know what happened after Charlemagne died. The dynasty began to crumble. You don't have primogeniture there, you have the division of land and income by the brothers almost equally. And he split it into three, each being ruled over by one of his grandsons. But only the kingdoms in the east and west survived. The middle one, of course, did not. But only was really until 9/11 in the east and the western part until 987 did the dynasty continue. And the Civil War from 840 to 843, the Carolingian Empire, for the good it did, was really based on one man, or really two men, Charlemagne and Louis the Pious. Louis the Pious was just as strong as Charlemagne himself was, and somebody else that the Western Orthodox Old Catholics should be paying attention to. So Hincmar is writing and is heading the church in France at a time of extreme chaos. The metropolitan is not a role anymore in the Western church, and there's good reason for that. And the reason is because the metropolitan was the national autocephalous chairman of the church, the clergy, that is. He was a spokesman for the national body, and he did think in national terms. Because of the chaos, it's bad enough, the Western Roman Empire falls, then the attempt to resurrect it falls. And near the end of Louis the Pious' reign, it falls completely into chaos, which means that he has to very tightly reform the church through constant synods, constant meetings, and to be very strict with his clergy. What happened was, because he deposed many, and chaos brings out the worst in people, and as he began to reform and tighten discipline through the monasteries, it was very easy for disaffected clergy to figure out a way to get back at him, and they did that by going to Rome. The papacy in Rome, especially under Nicholas I, wanted to exploit all kinds of divisions in the church in the West, and offering those who opposed these reformers, like Hincmar, greater power, even without a trial. The church was national in Hincmar, and it was essential to his theology. Pope Nicholas was already, at that early date, claiming that no synod was valid without papal permission. Hincmar, in defending the reign of Louis the Bald, claimed that that doctrine, while it has a solid foundation, is of very recent origin. It's about controls, not about truth. And one of the most significant, if not the most significant aspect of this, is that the decretals of Pseudo-Isidore were written specifically to attack Hincmar of Rheims. The power vacuum was being filled up by the papacy. The false decretals of Pseudo-Isidore are essential to the growth of papal power in the 9th century. We all know after the fall of the Roman Empire, Western nations were modified, bringing in new racial groups. And the church felt this change. And it harmed the chaos that it created for a time, harmed the society. And this is why the bishops of Rome began to take a more direct role in ruling the church there. They're sending missionaries, starting with St. Augustine all the way up to St. Boniface, for the sake of bringing the far-flung ethnicities of Northern Europe into the Roman fold, which in and of itself is not a problem, especially at the time. But what was happening in Rome was revolutionary. It began with Nicholas and ended with Gregory VII and the Gregorian reforms of the very late 11th century. The false decretals were, these are collections of canon law, many of them legitimate, but interspersed with them were deliberate forgeries. And they were accepted without protest because of the great ignorance that had fallen over Western Europe given the fall of these empires, both Charlemagne and the Roman Empire before him, as well as the civil wars and the division of Charlemagne's inheritance. So over time, these churches get used to papal control. The false decretals didn't create a new code necessarily, but they assisted papal orientation of the Western world because of, you know, political disturbances. The object, the purpose of the forgery was to attack the authority of the metropolitans. One of the most ancient roles in the church. And their job is to convoke national councils, specifically because they're on the ground. They know what's going on. The forgery was meant to concentrate all authority in Rome and to check the authority of the metropolitan. Of course, it worked because that whole designation of metropolitan was soon to disappear. So appeals to Rome, which were not common, they were allowed only after someone was deposed, but not before. An appeal to Rome offered a greater guarantee because sometimes you could be reinstated without a trial just for the sake of the political capital that you can build. Now, the Isidorian decretals claim to go back to the ancient world. And we know that they're forgeries for a lot of reasons, but one of which is that they use contemporary terms to describe the church in the first and second centuries. The forger, you know, talks about all these, you know, using these contemporary terms and relations, archbishops and primates and patriarchs for the first three centuries, as if it was in the 9th century. And of course, he ascribes to the Bishop of Rome full control, not just, you know, not just respect, not just prerogative, not just honor, but actual juridical control, which did not exist up until this point. And Hincmar didn't have the resources to refute the decretals. Even in the East, they accepted them for a while. So Hincmar says this. He's talking about, you know, he deposes a bishop and he goes running to Rome. And he says, let those who say all of this, that's okay, read the Acts of the Apostles and let them see. Some came down from Jerusalem to Antioch and raised up strife against Paul and Barnabas concerning the question of circumcision, the observance of the law. So much so that Paul and Barnabas decided to go to Jerusalem with others who had been sent to the apostles and preached for this question. And this question was raised by some of the Pharisees of Jerusalem after their arrival. Let them take note, this was settled by Peter and judged by James differently from how they had judged and settled it. But no one of them, none was condemned. Let them also see in the letter of Paul to the Galatians that Peter was criticized, rebuked, and corrected by Paul for pretense, but also was not condemned, and that his rebuke was accepted by the first among the apostles to the extent that he honored those letters of Paul in which he read that he was criticized with great praise. By stating that Peter was criticized here, Hincmar establishes that this wasn't a sacrosanct, that Peter was not a separate, you know, spiritual leader of the College of the Apostles. He had a certain amount of authority, but it doesn't mean he had a certain amount of power. Bishops, according to Pope Nicholas, were really just the eyes and ears of the Pope of Rome, which is something that Hincmar was not going to accept. You know, the notion of created grace, which Hincmar didn't quite catch yet, it really wasn't fully developed yet. Hincmar began to realize that bishops are really nothing more than an extension of the grace of the papacy. And he was slowly, you know, getting the outline of the concept that created grace was becoming the heresy. And he revolted against this by saying, concerning the idea that since there are no archbishops of greater authority than those, so that this matter should again come before them for judgment, we have shown above that what the singular cannot manage, a plurality can achieve, which the authority of Scripture demonstrates, saying, if two of you shall consent upon earth concerning anything whatsoever they shall ask, it shall be done to them. And where there are two or three gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. Now he's talking about this as these false decrees were being written and promulgated and used in official documents. And he's getting suspicious because he sees that this, you're giving the Pope this overweening power that it never even claimed before, very briefly maybe under Pope Leo, although for very good reason at the time. He's talking about the plurality of the council, bringing together not just clergy, but everyone of significance to solve problems of concern. Having only one person is dangerous. But it's not just that. It's not just the metropolitan, it's also a strong, nationally minded monarch. You connect that with realistic metaphysics, that is Platonic metaphysics, and you have the Carolingian royalist ideology. That for any reform, any improvement to occur during this chaos, all the elements of the church have to be together. You know, the monasteries, the people, the parishes, the clergy, and of course the upper clergy as well, not merely the Roman Pope. The king was supposed to impose order on chaos. That's what gave him his authority. He kind of recreates the natural order by putting form on matter. And of course, the parish, the monastery, they're all equally significant. And this is a time of great civil war and tremendous confusion. And you have tremendous intellectual battles going on in the West, really for the first time. Now, Charlemagne was able to reform to a great extent very quickly. And same thing for Louis the Pious, even Charles the Bald. Once they were dead, Rome sought to regain some lost ground there. And they attacked Hincmar head on. And their role was to divide the French church. And Rome realized very quickly that the French nation was already an ethnic and religious unit that had been formed since the fall of old Rome, and that this was going to become the foundation from which foreign claims could be challenged. Now, Charles the Bald, the successor to Louis, was given the two Roman provinces of Aquitaine and Burgundy. Now, I've argued for many years that the essential location for Western Europe in the Middle Ages was Aquitaine. It was the wealthiest part of Western Europe and the financial center of France. The road, infrastructure, the government were still very much Greco-Roman. And the papacy knew that at this time, that the church in Aquitaine was Greek. But he begins to challenge the arrogance of the papacy. At a time, of course, when Patriarch St. Phocis of Constantinople had himself excommunicated the Pope. And so the Pope now realizes that they need Hincmar to go after the Greeks, which he was in no position to do. But since Louis had control over the partly Greek province of Aquitaine, the combination of both Greek and Gallic nationalism against the papacy would have changed Europe forever. Not to mention the fact that this was a battle against the Islamic and Jewish empires in Spain, and the wars against it financed largely with Aquitanian money. So both Louis and Charles had proven themselves to be true monarchs, true successors to Charlemagne. And they were creating a Gallic Orthodox church centered to some extent in both Burgundy and Aquitaine. A truly Orthodox, non-papal church in France in close alliance with the Greeks. This was already developing when Hincmar was alive. This is why Hincmar was connected with Charles the Bald. And the victories in Spain were paid for by the wealthier Greek and Roman monasteries of Aquitaine and Burgundy. So they became an integral part of the growing nationalism under Louis and Charles. Now, the growing power of Charles the Bald and Hincmar did lead to a powerful Jewish oligarchy in Lyon developing, specializing in the slave trade. And he forced them, however, to disgorge their Christian slaves and contribute their money for the development of the new Franco-Roman state. So already the Jewish problem was identified by him, and they made war on it. Whenever you have improving economies, and Aquitaine was financing quite a bit of it, and they're on the water, they, you know, really the during the so-called Dark Ages, you had Aquitaine was, like with insular Ireland, a prosperous area with tremendous trade, speaking both Latin and Greek, although mostly Greek in the Aquitanian case. The Jews were attracted to this money, but thanks to the monarchy and the church under Hincmar, they didn't get very far. And they were beginning to mobilize the forces of the nascent French nation against the Judeo-Islamic imperial movement from North Africa. They did this by the regular calling of synods. So the means of constantly keep bishops, abbots, nobles in communication, settling abuses, making sure that discipline was maintained. G.C. Lee writes in his article, Hincmar, An Introduction to the Study of the Revolution and the Organization of the Church in the Ninth Century. This was written in 1896. He says, as this feeling of antagonism gathered force, the bishops became ready to take almost any means to rid themselves of metropolitan control. The surest method was direct appeal to the Pope, and thus turned the metropolitan out of his position in the carefully graded hierarchy. This possibility was a radical defect in the plan of Boniface, the very defect that was to give the Petrian See an authority undreamt of either by Boniface or Gregory. For a time, the plan of Boniface succeeded, and the majority of the clergy were brought to accept it. This success was largely due to the development of a spirit of nationality. The office of metropolitan was closely aligned to the national movement. The metropolitan, in a certain sense, stood for national unity. It was a prince of the church, and the church was divided according to race affiliations. A certain patriotism sprang up, which in ecclesiastical affairs centered on the primate, just as in political affairs is centered on the monarch. And that G.C. Lee wrote in 1896 in the papers of the American Society of Church History. So Hincmar then became a champion of the national rights of the Gallican Church, with its own liturgy and everything, with strong Greek influences. The metropolitan was a symbol of the ethnic and civic division of the old empire. This is why his role as metropolitan was absolutely essential. And centralizing authority in the metropolitan office as the judge of the first instance of the suffragan bishops, and to be the one to call provincial synods, especially in this emergency situation, without interference, was the agenda. And this was the conception of the rights of the metropolitans that led Hincmar to a conflict with Rome, especially Nicholas I. As the champion of papal rights, Nicholas I was extremely bold. As you know, he was at war with Constantinople as well. But this was not a legal matter. That's why the false decretals had to be written. But the sons of Louis drained the resources of the fragile empire in constant civil wars. So the church was as divided as anybody else, at least politically speaking. So, as always, in times of chaos, the nobles used the slow decay of institutions to plunder monastic houses. But both Louis the Pious and Charles the Bald were successful. But all that meant was that their sons and brothers ended up fighting for a larger piece of the pie for themselves. But Hincmar and Charles deposed many bishops for their immoral life. And they were aware that they were going to Rome and complaining. One of the most blatant examples of this was Rothagius, Bishop of Soissons, The case brought all this to a head. He was charged by Hincmar, his metropolitan, with having unjustly deposed a priest of his diocese and refusing to restore him. And that was it. That wasn't it. He also was charged with squandering church revenues, pawning sacred objects, selling vessels and ornaments without the consent of either the metropolitan or anyone else, and that he had not lived in a manner of becoming a bishop. And the Senate agreed with Hincmar, and he was deposed. The problem was there was no legal authority for this guy, Rathaudas, to appeal to Rome. So this is where the pseudo-Isidorian decretals come from. And it was Pope Nicholas, in a sermon, it was the first time these decretals were taken as having full authority. Now, it's true the Sardisian canons allowed an appeal to Rome, but not until the bishop had already been deposed. And only then would an appeal make any sense. But even there, it had tremendous reservations. The Pope was not in person to hear it, nor could the parties be brought to Rome. It was to be remanded to the local province, and a new court was to assemble under the presidency of papal legates, and the bishop was retried. You couldn't just go to Rome and the Pope could say whatever. It still had to be done in a conciliar way. And that was the grounds on which he fought Rathaudas's attempt to regain his see by going to Rome. The emperor was in no position to be a judge of these things anymore. The tradition and canons were in full force. But he attacked Hincmar. Nicholas attacked Hincmar using the pseudo-Isidorian decretals. These were forgeries. And he even went so far as to say even to doubt these is to commit sin. But the Pope ordered Hincmar to make instant satisfaction to, as he called, the injured and persecuted bishop, or to come to Rome in person. Any hesitation or delay was to lead to suspension or worse for Hincmar. And Hincmar refused all of this. Hincmar would not go to Rome and would not restate Rathaudas. He denied the right of the Bishop of Rome to restore a man who had already been tried and found guilty. And the Pope of Rome, Nicholas, without a trial, simply said, "You're going to reinstate him because I wasn't in on it." It wasn't just Hincmar, it was the whole province had refused to reinstate this man without an canonical acquittal at all. So there's a revolution going on here. The pseudo-Isidorian decretals that were soon to become official in the Gregorian reforms 150 years later, a little bit more, 200 years later, and taking advantage of the chaos and the old bases of nationality which are no longer stable because of these civil wars. Hincmar's nephew, also named Hincmar, Hincmar of Leon, he was accused of abusing several of his vassals. And the younger Hincmar said, "You can't take me to civil court in this regard. Charles of Bald had taken over this case personally." So the younger Hincmar went to Pope Adrian and even threatened to desert to Lothar II, which is Charles' rival, unless he got his way. So now he becomes a dangerous subversive, and he joins the aristocratic or oligarchic party against Charles after Lothar's death, which was known as the conspiracy of Carloman. So the oligarchs at the time were using these pseudo-Isidorian decretals to attack Hincmar and those loyal to Charles of Bald. But this is what they said, and this is what the Bishop of Lyon himself said. Unlimited right of appeal to Rome, opposition to every privilege pertaining to metropolitans, any interference of metropolitans in the management of any diocese is rejected, the restitution of an accused bishop, if the metropolitan did it, illegality of every synod that the Pope of Rome has explicitly called, an immediate restoration of any accused bishop without a synodal decree, that accusations against bishops being made more difficult, and of course, total acceptance of the decretals as law. Now, these eight marks are the aristocratic oligarchy attempting to take over, using Rome as a way to attack several things: the metropolitan, the monarch, and the national foundation. Now, Hincmar put out a strong refutation of his claims. And again, Hincmar wasn't sure about the... in fact, he seems to accept the decretals because he had no way of knowing whether they're true or false at the time. But his argument was that this had not been done before. This was revolutionary. You can't just overthrow metropolitans because things are difficult. And ultimately what he says is that the monarch is essential, more essential than the Pope in Rome. And he points to Charlemagne, he points to Louis, he points to Charles of Gaulle, and how important local synods were to these men. And so Hincmar begins to develop the notion of the keys to Peter as the way, or the rock of Peter, the way that Augustine did, the way that Gregory did, to reject the notion that Peter was the only apostle. But even to claim that Peter was the head of the apostolic college doesn't imply that he has power over anybody or jurisdiction over anybody. Those are two different things. All bishops, to the extent that they're Orthodox, have the power of the keys from Peter. Even in talking about the coronation of a monarch, Hincmar says, "For all these reasons, therefore, it seems to these venerable bishops not inappropriate, if it's pleasing to your unanimity, that in the possession of a realm from which you freely gathered to him and commended yourself to him, you should be crowned by priestly ministry before this altar and consecrated to the Lord by sacred unction. If this pleases you, please make a noise of consent with your own voices." So even in political power, he's talking about the councils absolutely necessary. It has to be done collectively, because society was generally healthy, despite the chaos around it. But even St. Augustine, you know, claiming that the pseudo-Isidorian decretals are legitimate because of the notion that, you know, Peter was the rock on which the church was built, St. Augustine himself, in his retractions, 120 section 1, says, no, it is the faith of Peter that's the issue, because Augustine had said something else before. And Augustine says, called after this rock, represented the person of the church which is built on this rock, has received the keys. For thou art Peter, and not thou art the rock was set to him, but the rock of Christ, in confessing whom, as the whole church confesses, Simon was called Peter. But let the reader decide which of these two opinions are more probable. And of course, his claim was, it had nothing to do with Peter as a man, it had to do with the fact that he had spoken the truth. And that's all that matters. Augustine had clearly rejected the connection of the rock with Peter. He said in Sermon 229, he said, "Christ, you see, built his church not on a man, but on Peter's confession. What is Peter's confession? You are Christ, Son of the living God. That's the rock for you. That's the foundation. That's where the church has been built, which the gates of the underworld cannot conquer." That's St. Augustine, Sermon 229. And he's the most significant church father, along with Gregory the Great, in the West at the time. And Gregory the Great himself, in talking to the Patriarch of Alexandria, explicitly states that the Petrine See is more than Rome. So even if Peter does have this claim to honor, it's not just Rome. Rome and Italy. He says Antioch, which is also a Petrine See, by the way, and Alexandria, which is as well. Mark was a student of Peter. Explicitly says that we're all part of the Petrine inheritance. And of course, Gregory the Great rejects, in the very same letter to the Patriarch of Alexandria, rejects the notion that there is a that the rock refers to Peter himself as a man, or let alone an office. And Gregory says, "Therefore, though there were many apostles, the single see of the prince of the apostles prevailed by his princedom, which now exists in three places. For it is he that made glorious that see where he consented to rest and close his present life." So there are three Petrine sees in St. Gregory's idea, and vehemently rejects the idea of a super bishop, as does Hincmar. The false decretals were seen as revolutionary. The decretals, which were supposed to be these much older ancient documents, weren't mentioned by anyone else before. So there was suspicion. But in Gregory the Great saying that Alexandria and Antioch are also Petrine sees, regardless of what you may think of the Apostle Peter, you still have more than the Bishop of Rome to contend with. Local national churches are created autonomously, not from Rome. That's the Frankish idea of autocephaly. Order for Hincmar doesn't come from a single juridical source. It comes from the local synod, led by the lawful Christian monarch on a national basis. Hincmar claims that people get the government that they deserve. He talks about the tyranny. He's not talking about the Pope here, but a bad ruler. He had to deal with many of them during these civil wars. He says bad rulers come into existence because people are already debased. Where would a tyrant come from? Tyranny requires a great degree of consent. If everyone withdrew their consent, no ruler can function. So for an illegitimate ruler to function, it means that society had long since already become reprobate. And a tyranny might be a good thing. But the church is no different in his mind. A Christian nation doesn't need oversight from a distant prelate. Oversight only comes from the church as a body, monastic prayer and struggle. Authority is the issue, not power. But authority comes from virtue. Power comes from legal claims. And of course, this is connected with his concern with nominalism, as I wanted to say. None of the sacraments make any sense if you accept nominalism as true, whether it be the Eucharist or even the doctrine of the Trinity itself. The famous nominalist Roscelin, which is one of the earlier metaphysicians of the time, basically, you know, contemporaneous with what's going on here, was also tried for tritheism, or the rejection of the Trinity. And tritheism claims that there's one God that wears three masks. But a mask is all that a nominalist can see. The nominalist can only see power. There's a connection between the Isidorian decretals, the rule of oligarchy, and papal control in this period of time, taking advantage of chaos. There are three gods in the nominalist world because they can't see universals. You can only be seen as an individual and nothing else. If you reject Platonic metaphysics, the notion of tritheism becomes almost irresistible. Because all there could ever be is masks. Something is true because God says it is, not because it's a part of his essence. Something is true because God says so. That's all the nominalist could ever see. And as society decays, in this era or in any era, nominalism takes over because all they could see is power and control. And the Eucharist only makes sense to someone who accepts the realist metaphysical concept. The Eucharist only exists in the church. It is Eden remade. Logos isn't present in as a mere natural force. It has a separate presence without any accidents or without its normal accidents. Its God as a man is present there, not merely his energy and nature. He's present in the Eucharist as a man, but although in his glorified form, post-resurrection form. The same thing goes for marriage. You can't talk about a family as being made up of individuals. That doesn't make any sense. The family comes first. Individuals come from the family, not the other way around. The notion of sexual intercourse is absolutely essential to marriage because there you have the physical manifestation of two people becoming one. Actually, literally, for a time. This is why fornication is such a problem. Realism only makes sense here. If you're a nominalist, sex is nothing more than masturbation. For a realist, sex is a final overcoming of alienation. it's the foundation of a community. But if you're a nominalist, especially in a very strict sense, the family ends up being just this random unit without substance. You have people today, you have libertarians today claiming that the family is nothing more than people who use their rational self-seeking. They love their parents because they get something from them. The parents get something from the kids and vice versa. That's why the family exists. It's all egotistical self-seeking. Well, that's all they can see. Hinckmar talks about adultery in this same sense. He says, for by natural reason, the woman is part of the body of the man. And though this man loves himself and the woman, in which way, if he should fornicate, he sins in himself, since two are one flesh. The persons do not, therefore, divide the substance, so that through persons, the number of nature may happen, but the natures are in unity. They become one person. This is why realism is so absolutely critical. This is why Platonic metaphysics is so important. The doctrine of forms, of essences separate from matter. And because humans are rational, that's the very definition of human, consent is important. So whether you're talking about the bishop in a church, monarchy over the nation, or father of a family, you have hierarchy, you have realism, you have metaphysics. You have the absolute opposite of nominalism. That the truth of the community is instantiated in a man's wife, just as it is in the church, just as Christ appeared in Mary. But these aren't real things unless they're conceived as a community supported by other larger communities. In all of these areas, you have two separate things becoming one. The form has to show itself in matter. It can't exist by itself. Without the physical, the spiritual is of no effect, so long as we have a body. That's why we have a particular judgment and a final judgment. Particular judgment is just the soul. Well, the soul doesn't operate by itself. The only way to judge someone is having both soul and body unified together again. And sexual intercourse is about creating babies because the good is always fecund. It always seeks to manifest itself and reproduce itself. But because we have bodies, we're in bodies, we have senses, we have to learn by pieces. You can't just know the form as such. You have to slowly build our knowledge inductively. So long as we have bodies, there has to be a physical manifestation to the spiritual elements. That's what the sacraments are. That's what the liturgy is. That's what icons are. The form of the thing is more real than the changing manifestation of it. The family lasts longer than the individual. The nation lasts longer than the family. The manifestations aren't as real as that which it manifests. But we need these physical manifestations for it to be complete for us. That's simply how we're made. Spirit and flesh have to work together as one. But all the sacraments have the same purpose. And Hinckmar probably thought that the coronation of a monarch was another sacrament. You had a lot of people thinking that at the time. It's to bring the scattered remnants of a true life together into unity. The family, meaning the extended family, then the nation, then the empire, with the church as the agency for this unity, the leaven, so to speak. The nation derives from the family, and the empire is a collection of nations. The church is exactly the same, and follows the exact same pattern. And they're baptized into the church, so they all become one with heaven, without removing their distinctiveness, which is identical with the Trinity. Now, a nominalist can't understand any of that, because there are no universals. They're only individual things. The concept of good exists only in the specific things that we may point to and say that's good. There is no overarching concept of good that manifests itself in different ways. But for Hinckmar, as well as everyone in this era pretty much, except for those that I've mentioned, a tiny handful, and heresies to a great extent based on it, the goodness and justice and truth that a father has in the family, a monarch has in the nation, a bishop has in the church, are identical. In essence, not in accident, of course. Of course, they manifest themselves very differently, but the nature of justice in each case is the same. They're not similar because they vaguely, metaphorically look like each other. No, they are the same. For any knowledge, for any meaning to exist at all, you have to have an essence which is unchanging. Without form, the world is a disconnected set of appearances. Any natural law requires it. Any law of nature rests on a universal. But a universal isn't material. It's spiritual. Therefore, it has to have a cause. What's the cause of anything spiritual? All principles of any kind exist from universals. The only other option is to worship power and control and coercion, no different than billiard balls on a pool table. Without universals, only impressions remain. But listen to how Hincmar talks to the monarch about how he is to, this is from the Queersey letter, very famous work of political theory at the time. And this is, you know, to Charles de Bald. I mean, there was other people were in on this, but this was largely Hincmar's creation. He was talking about the royal household, which is the center of administration. And it's no different than any other type of rule. It's all one and the same. He says, nourish, rule, and arrange your household in such a way that when the people of the kingdom assemble before you, they may see in you and your retainers how soberly, justly, piously, with how much humility and chastity they ought to nourish, arrange, and govern their household too. For as a certain wise man once said, the family will be safe according to the habits of its master. And that is why the king's household is called a school, that is a disciplina. Not so much because they're scholars like others, that is disciplined and well-corrected people, but rather it's called a school, by which we mean a disciplina, correctio, because they correct others in behavior, progress, in word and deed, in the preservation of all goodness. You know, before celebrities took over as a role model, this ruling elite was the models of behavior, along with the saints. The problem with injustice at that level was that it justified it for others. You know, a corporation can't manipulate consumers, then get upset when a consumer declares bankruptcy and avoid paying bills. If you accept the notion of self-interest, like Anomalous does, you have nowhere to stand when others more powerful than you do the same to you. The ruler sets the tone. The guardian of the law has to follow the law with tremendous strictness, but that can't happen without humility and a tight control over the passions. It's extremely powerful to understand that this is one and the same kind of thing. He says, unless you're supported by the God of virtues, you'll be like a peg which is not secure. You will fall, and those hanging from you will slip. So therefore, as God taught when he was being tempted to render those constituted under power, what is of Caesar and what is of God, likewise, you who are under God and above men, render to God what is of him. Like a just Caesar, render to the subject what belongs to them. Render to your subjects judgment with mercy, justice with equity. Take care to exalt the humble and God-fearing. Subdue and humiliate the proud. Take care that the wicked fear to do evil things, if not on account of God, then at least fear of you. Let not a lying tongue, a full hand, or unearned subservience be worth more than your truth, equity, and sincerity. This is what he's talking about. He says, do not hate the men of the country. Do not devastate their harvest vineyards. Do not seize and plunder their cattle. And tolerate no one who takes it away through trickery. Who hold offices, who acquire profit, so that the house of God and the orphans of people may have justice, who take more care to bring the litigants to peace, with justice preserved, than commit them to legal action, so that they can have profit from it. If they can't placate them, then as is just, let them make a just judgment with great care. This is what a just ruler does. It doesn't matter what institutions are there. If the passions aren't brought under control, anything could be subverted. If passions are brought under control, justice will automatically flow, since the desire for profit won't rule people. It can't rule people. To appoint evil people is to promote evil and send the message that evil people get rewarded. If governors are corrupt, There's no reason why the mass of the population shouldn't follow suit. If one is being exploited for another's profit, it's proper that this be compensated for in some way. That's where local, popular corruption comes from. If they could do it, we can do it. Lawlessness begets more lawlessness. It's a further proof of realism. Injustice is the same everywhere, since its absence, the absence of a just distribution of the good, just only on a smaller or larger scale, with different ends in view. But the fundamental truth is exactly the same. Injustice is a lopsided distribution, because someone is taking more than they deserve. They do this because they can't control their ego. So for him, ultimately, a just ruler has three elements. The different corporations and elites of the society have to unanimously support him. Number two, he has to be of Carolingian blood. And finally, he has to be coordinated properly by the church. Those are the three qualifications for legitimacy. He wanted a unification of the Frankish church and the Carolingian government to create peace and stability. He wants to eliminate injustice. The problem is that evil is easy. Peace is necessary because it provides the necessary conditions for the consistent practice of religion and the virtues. Anything, culture, art, music, art, liturgical services. The Franks can be a new Israel. And there's nothing wrong with this. This is what Hincmar of Reims did, and he saw in the power grab of the Pope of Rome, Nicholas I in particular, the rule of oligarchy, the rule of aristocracy, in the worst sense, the rule of money, the magnates fighting the legitimate monarch from Charlemagne, Louis, and then Charles of Gaulle. He condemns usury in no uncertain terms. He realizes that luxury comes on the backs of the peasantry. That gaining your money through rents rather than labor is unjust. Repentance, including the public repentance from a monarch, is a legitimate check on the power of the elite. And it has to be done. St. Ambrose did it with the emperor. It happens. In a time of great chaos, as Western Europe was being depopulated, as you have a complete destruction of Roman civilization, you had a few holdouts in France. One of those holdouts was the great Hincmar, and laying out at a time of great chaos what legitimacy and justice was. And he saw in the papacy a Machiavellian power grab using forgeries, which we today now are complete forgeries, but they didn't know that at the time, to justify putting the wrong people back into power for no other reason than it made the papacy seem that much more significant. The nation existed, the nation was powerful, and even then it was fighting oligarchy. And unfortunately at the time, given the Phocian problem in Constantinople, the papacy was already tottering. Church and state are distinct but very closely related. One doesn't function without the other. Marriage is another aspect of the social whole, an agreement among free people. It's not a social contract, but the promotion of reason. There has to be consent. The role of the parents is the same as the king and queen. They watch over the family order. This is why Hincmar is talking about the royal household. It's no different than a humble household. It has to be organized in the same way. The family is the elemental society offered in miniature. But without strong fathers, it can't be done, whether it be bishops or monarchs. And to have outside interference and attacks and a papacy that would use any kind of division and any complaining as a way to try to take over, this wasn't conducive to this at all. And the developing nations of Western Europe came under attack from the papacy at the time. Anyway, everyone, thank you for listening. I appreciate all your donations to me. The struggle continues. I ask you to continue to do that. I have a paper on Hincmar coming out very soon. And I appreciate you taking the time to support me. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.